many more times than I can count. I have called you mine. You have stood by me in my
life from New York City. It's the Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Lots to share with you today. The latest on health and healing. Interesting, because of the work of millions of individuals educating their friends and others about the significance of organic foods, there's actually a shortage. We're running out of organic food. That's good news for those who would like to grow it and market it, but we have to catch up. My hope is within the next 12 to 24 months, we'll have 20, 30,000 additional farmers out there, either part-time or full-time. This is the latest on that. Then we'll go to some of the other issues. I have lots of issues. From Natural News, quote, organic food is seemingly no longer just a trend, but a necessity. A recent report states that all natural food grocers can hardly keep up with the demands for organic food. Bloggers have been capturing signs that read, quote, organic eggs are currently in short supply due to increased consumer demand and limited availability. This is an industry-wide shortage and is not specific to ShopRite stores or operation. Now, similar signs are being seen in grocery stores across the nation. Cage-free organic eggs and certain types of organic produce are among the products in shortage across the country. Now, of course, you could blame global warming. Why? Because the seasons don't get you the kind of rain you need, and that is going to cause stunting of growth. Also, with a lot of bees dying, and it takes time to get organic bees situated. You can't just take over a farm. Well, you can, and you should. But it's going to take about 3 years before that soil is cleansed of the pesticides, depending upon the type of soil, that was used before. But then you've got to get pollination and pollinators. A lot of things pollinate. Moths pollinate, birds pollinate, but bees are the big pollinators. They're the most important ones. And it might take 5 or 10 years to get an area fully pollinated, especially if you're in the plains area. If you're in the tropics, that's easy. If you're in a milder climate where there's plenty of food for the bees, lots of nectar, lots of flowers, including wildflowers, that's easy. You get a cold winter, ice and snow, you're not going to have bees. They're going to die. So as a beekeeper and as a certified organic farmer that I've been a farmer my whole adult life, I can tell you that the future looks very good for those moving back to the land. In fact, I would say that would be one of the most exceptional positive things that you can do, and millions are doing that. So you've got a greater demand than you have supply. And in fact, one of the things we're saying here from Austin, Texas, down in Texas, you've got a greater demand for organic produce than you have people able to grow it. How about that? Same is true for Dallas. Dallas and Austin just happen to be the two most progressive cities from my research in the United States. They dwarf Manhattan, L.A. Of course, they don't dwarf them in the spectacle of great cultural events and some outstanding minds and creativity. But as far as a culture of progressive ideals and people, there's no place near that. So, another good opportunity. There's a research project that wanted to see, could they help people with diabetes? And what they did is they took a traditional Chinese medicine approach. At the University of Chicago, they first looked to see what would be the best Chinese herbal medicine to use, especially to slow the advancement from pre-diabetes to full-blown diabetes. Now, keep in mind, in the United States, you have anywhere from 25 to 30 million diabetics, but then you have about 60 million pre-diabetics. So you're getting up to 90 to 100 million people. It's a serious situation. So then they gave one group of patients for a period of time, they gave them a mixture of herbs, and all told there's 10 herbs. Now I'll spell the name for you. T-I-A-N-Q-I. It's very well known in Chinese medicine. And you, if you want to get it, you could get it in Chinatown or some of the compounding pharmacies, or in possibly some of the health food stores that know more about herbs. Anyhow, that Tainqui was the supplement they used. And then they gave another group a placebo, sugar pill. And that's what went on for 1 year. The results were published in the peer-reviewed Journal of Clinical Endocrinology and Metabolism. And what they found is that the hundreds of pre-diabetics who had this single Chinese herbal mixture had a substantial reduction in blood sugar, 32% cut their risk of developing diabetes. That's a big amount. When the United States, that would be, you're looking at 20 to 30 million Americans whose lives could be saved. Why? Because the moment you're diabetic, your risk of heart attack, stroke, cancer, depression, all increase measurably. So something good and easy. This is to answer Linda, who approached me recently while I was filming. I'm 26 days to go in my current filming. I'm filming right now 4 different programs. This week it'll be filming in California, and then back to New York for 3 months, where I'm planning my next major film. It's all about the environment. I'll go into it when I get back, because I promised people in the audience who would be interested in watching to see how a documentary is filmed from beginning to end, so people could come in and see each stage of it, the planning of it, the collecting of B-roll, the working with my editors and frontline producers, and then how I go out on the road and find the experts and go to the different locations, Greenland, Antarctica, Sahara Desert, the up in the Himalayas, because all these are required for this particular documentary. In any case, this person stopped and said, "I heard you like mustard. I've never really eaten mustard because I don't eat the hot dogs, and that's how most people eat them. What's good about mustard?" I was thinking about that. I wonder how many other people don't realize mustard is one of the most perfect foods you can have. Well, it's a perfect condiment. And I'd find different ways of getting it on the dishes I like. In fact, I just mix it up into a salad dressing, too. I make a honey orange mustard, where I'll take fresh, I'll grate some orange, and then I'll put manuka honey. I'll put some little apple cider vinegar, some lemon juice, mustard, and extra virgin olive oil, a little bit of flaxseed oil, blend all that, and then that is a delicious salad dressing. And that way you get all those other good things. Here's why I use mustard. Mustard comes from a plant from the genus called Brassica, B-R-A-S-S-I-C-A. That's loaded with good things. Horseradish, cress, kale, broccoli, Brussels sprouts are also in that. And it has been around for a long time. A mustard was used clear back when Hippocrates was practicing medicine. Why would you want it? First, because it contains what are called isothiocyanates. Those can suppress and prevent the growth of cancerous tumors. There was a study published in Carcinogenesis, the peer-reviewed journal, demonstrating that when this compound is delivered in a specialized manner, it has the ability to inhibit growth of cancer in the bladder. But it also is strongly anti-inflammatory. It's loaded with antioxidants, selenium and magnesium as well, and it turns off pain. It also has lots of potassium, the omega-3 fatty acids, the omega-6 fatty acids. And it also, for athletes or people over the age of 40, there's a compound in mustard seed called homobrassinolide. It is it's able to increase lean muscle mass. It's a natural type of steroid that can increase your appetite and food intake while helping to develop muscle growth. So it's important for people who need to gain muscle, especially older people who are wasting in muscle. In fact, the Federation of American Society of Experimental Biology study found that the anabolic effects of that particular compound, the homobrasinolide, are enough to increase strength and lean muscle mass. And then, of course, there are other medicinal uses for it. And it's been used for people with alleviating achy muscles and joint pain, even fighting pneumonia. My mom would always use a mustard pack on our chest, all of us boys, when we were growing up, if we were coming down with a cold or flu. So I hope that answers your question there. I am going to be starting probably in maybe 6 months from now to do another one-year menopause-andropause study. The last one I did was 5 years ago. It was incredibly successful because for the first time, we were able to take a group of individuals who stuck with the protocol. If you didn't do your homework, you didn't get in the class. You were excluded permanently. And after that, they saw 40 or 50 people not being able to get in because, oh, I didn't do it. Too bad, you're out of the study. So it's very strict, but the results were phenomenal. Nothing ever before, not anywhere in American scientific history, had there been a study with human beings for a year, meeting every week for 3 hours, showing you could reverse hair loss, menopausal symptoms, hot flashes, thinning of the vagina, the thinning of the skin, the fatigue, urinary tract infections, mood swings, thinning of the eyebrows, thinning and fungus under the nails, all these maybe 60 different conditions, any number which might happen to a given individual, and we reversed them. And they stayed reversed. So we have a lot more information. But this is something most people are not aware of. This is from the University of Pennsylvania. Quote, hot flashes can last 10 years after menopause. Moderate to severe hot flashes continue on average for nearly 5 years after menopause. And more than a third of women experience moderate to severe hot flashes 10 years. And this was published in the peer-reviewed journal Menopause. So we're saying that's true based upon the Penn Ovarian aging study that was done, and you're at greater risk if you have hot flashes and you're an obese person, really a greater risk. And it's also true based upon the study of women's health across the nation. And African-American women also report higher symptoms of hot flashes. But I say it's not true. If you change your pH, if you change your diet, if you stop pro-inflammatory ingredients and you reverse the aging of the cell. So now that this new study is out, what we're going to do is we're going to, in about 6 months, we're going to ask men and women who currently have hot flashes. That'll be one of the criteria. And to enroll in the study for 1 year and see if we can't reverse that. And then do a follow-up for the next year to see it that they lost the weight, gain muscle, have no symptoms, they're able to sleep, their skin comes back, their hair comes back, their nails come back, their immune system comes back, their energy comes back, the human growth hormone, and all positive hormones come back. That's the goal. So that's coming. Here's something I thought was important. We know that stress in a negative way, called distress, adversely affects the person who's experiencing it. We also know that when you're around someone who's highly distressed, negative, bitter, accusatory, that you feel down, you feel dragged into this vortex of negativity. In fact, I've done about 10 self-empowerment documentaries approaching the problem from different angles, including the most well-known one called Overcoming the Dark Side. Here's what's new from the University of California, San Francisco, published in the peer-reviewed journal Psychological Sciences. Quote, stress can be contagious. Infants can catch it from their mothers. Whoa. Think of what we did not intellectually understand about what was occurring with our parents, but we became the epigenetic sponge before that. And then even though today we're certainly able to understand on an intellectual level and process on an emotional level that which happened earlier in life, we still act it out. It's still there. Quote, new research shows that babies not only pick up the mother's stress, but they also show corresponding physiological changes. Our research shows that infants catch and embody the physiological residue of their mother's stressful experiences. That's according to researcher Sarah Walters, the scholar at the University of California. Quote, for many years now, social scientists have been interested in how emotions are transmitted from one person to another. And a professor of emotion at the University of California, Wendy Mendez, says, indeed, research in the social sciences has shown that emotions can be contagious and there is emotional syncope between romantic partners. All right. Well, it works in both directions. You can't have a universal truth unless you have it applicable in both sides of an issue. Meaning, you can't say that the negative emotions of distress are contagious and impact a person without also affirming the other side. Positive emotions are contagious as well. Hence, we enjoy laughter, we enjoy joy, we enjoy spontaneity and surprises, and we have those ooh-ah moments when we see something in nature that enthralls us. All the time I'm sending to all the people I know beautiful images from nature, and they all respond, you know, wow, these were terrific to look at. Of course, we're sharing something. It's contagious. Negativity is contagious. That's why you have a Republican Party, and depression and infighting, that's contagious. That's why you have liberals, right? That why smile and find joy in each other when you can take a pitchfork and stab each other in the head? And just go to any local station board meeting and you'll understand what I'm saying. So why not look at the consequences of what we do before we do it and ask, what would we like? Something joyful, happy, positive? Yes. Creative, optimistic? You bet. It's contagious. Just remember, that's in everything we do. Once again, a universal truth means that if it's contagious at home, it can be contagious at work. Hence the power of having positive people and looking forward to something that you collectively agree is a good idea, working towards some good standard. So finally, they're proving scientifically what many of us have known for a long time. And I call it the exchange of energy phenomena. I found this out. In fact, you can, if you've not been up on my website and gone to the photo gallery and look under the personal photos, you'll see some that are clearly in a laboratory. I'm in a laboratory, white outfit, and you'll see other people. Well, that's the Institute of Applied Biology, where I was a research scholar and fellow for 30 years in anti-aging research. But I also did a side research there that I couldn't really talk about because the rest of the place was very orthodox doing cancer research. And I wanted to see whether or not it was true that emotions and optimism and even some spiritual energy could flow through a person into what we consider an inanimate object, in this case, rats that I had borrowed that were going to be killed downstairs and in their chemotherapy work. And so you'll see people. One, you'll see the gentleman is Rabbi Abraham Wiseman. Another, a woman. I think she's in a checkered outfit, short kind of salt and pepper hair. That's Dr. Dolores Krieger, head of nursing at New York University. And what they're doing, they're transferring energy from these cancerous mice through their meditation into the animal. Well, there were others I didn't get photographs of. Dr. Morton Jacobs, a chiropractor. He was known as the chiropractor with the healing hands. Dr. Thomas Kruth, the Order of Seminary of St. Luke. And we had others as well. But a lot of people were not able to demonstrate this. But 5 out of 5 people did for 2 years in 8 total experiments. So it was completely confirmed. I wrote a journal article on it. It was published in the Journal of Psychotronic Research, showing that there was a phenomenon of exchange of energy, meaning the healing energy of these people exchanged the cancer and dying energy within the animal. And then I said, well, if it works in animals, it's got to work in humans. And then the idea of loving embraces, of a mother kissing her baby, all the things we do, holding hands, cuddling, all the things that allow us to feel an enormous energy, which then triggers biochemical response. We have one wonderful hormone in the body, in both men and women, that when triggered, gives us that euphoric feeling. That's still energy. It's all energy. Excuse me. So just remember, in life, whatever you share will have an impact. So shouldn't we be morally, ethically, and spiritually responsible to try to share the best possible energy? I think so. And that is our health and nutrition report. Now let's go to some environmental information and also some public health. Excuse me. From our public health segment this morning, this is from Dr. Joseph Marcola. He did some good research here, and he found the following. Quote, based upon guidelines of discredited research, and this was just in the European Journal of Cardiology, the guidelines on beta blockers used in patients undergoing non-cardiac surgery. They used the wrong information based upon the careless collection of the data for the research, and this has led to 800,000 preventable deaths. That's just one wrong step. The paper, originally published in the online version of the European Heart Journal, is a testament to the dangers of modern medicine and why scientific rigor needs to be reestablished as the norm. And as Dr. Marcola has discussed, scientific misconduct by medical researchers affects real people, real lives. And when flawed research is used as the basis for medical guidelines, people shouldn't die, but they do. So this is just one mistake in one journal of giving these beta blockers to non-cardiac surgeries when they should not have had them, and 800,000 people died. Was anyone held accountable? Nope. Anyone have to say they're sorry? Not at all. So I share this with you because in the next 2 months, we are doing a comprehensive update of death by medicine to show you that more Americans will die this year than in any American war, from the Civil War, First World War, Second World War. More Americans will be killed this year by medicine, iatrogenesis. And no one will be held accountable. They will all be paid and rewarded for killing people. Nothing will change. There will be no sense of irony. There will be no moment where they'll stop and say, if we've killed this many people, shouldn't we reevaluate what we're doing? No, they haven't. And they'll continue to kill people. It's a medical genocide, and it's not going to stop. And there'll be no moment, there'll be no committee, there'll be no reform, there'll be no nothing. One more reason why you have to make sure that as much as you can do to stay healthy, you should. And if you are sick, first go to a non-orthodox medical doctor. There are plenty of board-certified physicians, nurse practitioners, and others qualified in the healing field to give you advice, so you're not a statistic. In a few moments, in about 10 minutes now or so, we're going to talk with Dr. Marcia Shapiro from Berkeley on dealing with anxiety in our anxious age. Before we go there, however, we still have some other reports and some commentaries that I want to share with you. And one from Chris Hedges and one from Marjorie Cohen. Both of those are important. But now from our environmental segment. Over the last week, I've shared two reports about how bad the situation is in California, and it's only going to get worse. Now, a lot of you listening right now listen for 31 years to my six-hour program every week on our sister station, KPFK. But I chose to leave there, and I had hoped that many people would begin to make a change in their life to get out of that state. But unfortunately, people generally don't move. They're bounded by security, by familiarity, by family obligations, by career. And then one day, they're forced to. Then they don't know what to do. This is from Kirian Cook from climatenetwork.net. Quote, "The drought intensifies in the western United States. Now, what I'm about to share with you is based upon official statements, and they say it's going to get much, much worse." Quote, "In recent days, California has announced its most severe water restrictions ever as drought continues to hit the state. Scientists say the region's rainfall has been declining over the years, and the consequences are serious. It's the month and usually wettest in the western U.S. when rivers and reservoirs are replenished. This year, there are virtually no rain in much of the region, and this is following an exceptionally dry period through the last 12 months. A vast area of land in the western region of the American landmass, stretching from the province of Alberta in Canada across to the parts of Texas in the United States and on down into Mexico and clear out to the Pacific Ocean, is suffering as reservoirs and rivers dry up. A state of emergency has been declared in several areas, including California. Dr. Wallace Covington is director of the Ecological Restoration Institute at Northern Arizona University. Quote, "What we're seeing across this region is an intensification of long-established aspects of climate change. I hate to sound pessimistic, but all around these large watersheds, we're seeing a degradation of water structure and function. There's increased erosion leading to desertification, and with the dry conditions and generally stronger winds, the forest fire season is being extended." End quote. Now, Covington is an internationally recognized expert, and he's also talking about, well, when drought comes, and they're now in Arizona in a 30-year drought, you have other problems. Quote, "Longer drought periods and increasing temperatures are resulting in attacks of bark beetles, which can eventually kill off trees, becoming increasingly severe. The trees can't produce adequate moisture. If enough photosynthesis is going on, they can fight off the beetles and their larvae. But in the northern Arizona area, we've been under drought conditions for about 30 years, and it's getting worse. We've been losing pines that are 400 years old at an alarming rate," end quote. If you want to see photographs, last year I was in this exact area. I was at the highest point in Arizona. I went up to do my one-week spiritual meditation where I just go alone. I sit with 5 gallons of water, and that's it. And I meditate, come back. Well, someone who was passing by who recognized me from PBS was talking, and I got him to take some photos. I wanted people to see the beauty of being up at about 13, 14,000 feet. But all around, you see everything burning. I mean, 100 feet from where I was, there was smoldering, and everywhere there was fires. I hadn't seen that before up there. That's the new norm. And then going back down the mountain, back down through Sedona, you see it's drying out, parched. And Phoenix, it's just like an oven. And so it's over. It's not going to get any better. And this is the final thing that we're now seeing. Quote, "At the end of last month, California State Water Project, the largest state-built water and power development and distribution system in the United States, said it would stop supplying water to local agencies in many areas in order to use what little bit of remaining water, quote, as wisely as possible. The agencies, which supply water to 25 million people and 750,000 acres of farmland in California, would in future have to look elsewhere for water, including from local reservoirs or from groundwater." Quote from Jerry Brown, "Water shortages are a stark reminder that California's drought is real." Okay, let's go back to what I just said here. 25 million people? That's 60% of the total population of California. Now, they can't get the water that they would always expect from the California State Water Project because it's empty. Okay, so go use your local reservoirs. But they're empty. Well, go to your local lakes. They're almost empty. Well, use streams. No water. They're dry. Well, pump new wells. Some of those wells could cost $300,000 and $400,000 per well. Well, we'll truck water in. How many trucks do you think it would take to fill the needs of people who are going to have that every day when you have 25 million people who need it? And then what about that 750,000 acres of farmland? That's an awful lot of produce that's not going to be available. That means massive shortages of food. Quote, in Southern California, an area which produces a wide variety of vegetables, fruits, nuts, and other crops, farmers are complaining that water supplies are being diverted to towns and cities from their lands. It's not as if there hasn't been enough warning about what's happening. These changes have been going on over decades, but the trouble is our political management systems respond only in 4 or 5 year cycles, not in 40 to 50 year trends. This is above national, it's global, yet our institutions are national at best, and we don't have a lot of time to act, end quote. Okay? Just letting you know, there's some places you shouldn't be moving, and if you are there, you should consider other places. I'm Gary Knoll. We're halfway through our program today. Two short commentaries that are relevant. And then continuing from yesterday, the challenging casino capitalism's punishing factories. And the anonymity of the corporate state becomes invisible as historical and public memory are erased and the American public is increasingly infantilized. Stupidity is normalized through a consumer celebrity culture. And where that does not work, the machinery of state repression, with its endless culture of fear, punishes those willing to question authority. Authorities try to blind people to the courage exhibited by whistleblowers such as Chelsea Manning and Jeremy Hammond and Edward Snowden. And tomorrow on this program, I will have that half-hour interview with German television by Edward Snowden that you can't get on the Internet. It keeps being erased. We'll have it here. And they shouldn't be painted as traitors. They're heroes. Courage is now under attack by this sterile and dangerous call for unchecked security. Fear becomes the only value left in the arsenal of the machinery of surveillance and control and social death. David Graeber is right in arguing that the call for public dialogue, dissent, and critical exchange in order to hold power accountable no longer provokes informed judgment and outrage among the public or thoughtful responses from politicians and popular pundits. On the contrary, just the opposite. American politics and culture have been handed over to the rich, the lobbyists for the corporate elite, and now function largely to produce a state that offers the ultra-wealthy and powerful all the benefits they need to accumulate even more capital, regardless of the massive inequality in wealth, income, and suffering such policies produce. In spite of being discredited by the economic recession of 2008, unfettered casino capitalism remains a dominant force and continues to produce runaway environmental devastation, egregious amounts of human suffering, and the reinforcement of what Charles Ferguson has called finance as a criminalized rogue industry. And yet, while resistance to such measures is growing, it is far too weak to offer a significant challenge to the new authoritarianism. All over the world, forces of casino capitalism are invoking austerity measures that produce a kind of social and civil death as they dismantle the historically guaranteed social provisions provided by the welfare state, defining profit-making as the essence of democracy, expanding the role of corporate money in politics, and waging an assault on unions, augmenting the military security state, overseeing widening social inequality, promoting the erosion of civil liberties, and undercutting public faith in the defining institutions of democracy. The script is not new, but the intensity of the assault on democratic values and civic engagement and public service has taken a dangerous turn and provides the ideological, political, and cultural foundation for a society that seems unaware it is in the midst of an authoritarian stranglehold on all of its most cherished institutions, ranging from our schools and the health care to the very foundation of democracy. Austerity has become the weapon of choice, an economic poison designed to punish the middle and working classes while making clear that casino capitalism will administer the most severe penalties to those who challenge its authority. The police have become the new private armies of the rich, designed to keep the public in check, hoping to make them fearful of being exposed to police brutality, state violence, or the expanded machine of the multiple surveillance apparatuses that now collect every piece of information that circulates electronically. Conformity has become the order of the day, and fear the new norm, reinforced by mismanagement and the punishing state now mutually informing each other. In conclusion, higher education, especially in the post-World War II period through the 1960s and 70s, however ideally considered a place where young people were taught how to think, engage in critical dialogue, and take on the responsibilities of informed and critical citizens. Now such students are subject to a technically trained docility, defined largely as consumers, and told that they only value education in a way that prepares them to be workers and consumers, ready and eager to serve the ideological and financial interests of the global economy. Critical thought and radical imagination have become a liability under our current system, and for a growing number of institutions, the public no longer considers the value of what it has learned, but rather, did I pass? Where will I go? Did I get the A? And because they hold the potential to be at odds with the reproduction of the criminogenic culture in which greed, unchecked power, political illiteracy, and unbridled self-interest work to benefit the wealthy and corporate elite, they are willing to stand in line and saying, I will serve you next if I get some in return. Under such circumstances, education becomes simply a business, developing an obsession with accountability schemes, measurable utility, authoritarian governing structures, and a crude empiricism for defining what counts as research. Tomorrow, a continuation. I'm Gary Knoll. Now, for those who have been led to believe that President Obama is a socialist, or he wants to redistribute the wealth from the rich to the poor, or that he wanted all along a universal health care system, nothing could be further from the truth. This man is no different than Hillary and Bill Clinton and all the other little Clintonites and corporate Democrats and corporate liberals, the limousine liberals. They're great at talking. They're great at showing up and kissing babies and walking through poor neighborhoods. Have you ever seen them live there? No. They don't care about the poor or the working class because they're not a part of it. They just want you to believe that they're a part. Here's the truth from a recent report, and I've said this all along. We should have universal health care, but Obama's the last person in the world who's trying to give it to you, and he is very much trying to redistribute the wealth, what's left of the poor and working class, into the hands of those who put him in office, the rich and powerful. Please listen up. This is instructive.
During the 2009 debate about the health care bill, President Obama and his administration claimed, look, of course we'd love to do single payer, but we just, golly gee, we just can't. So they used to say about the public option, oh, public option, love the public option, just can't do it. Republicans twisted our arm. When in reality, there was no evidence that the Republicans twisted their arm at all. Now, would the Republicans have been opposed to that? Of course they would have been, right? But they didn't even try. Now we find out, because of Brian Schweitzer, that in fact, not only were they not trying, in the case of single payer, they were actually working actively against it behind the scenes. How do we know this? Well, Brian Schweitzer was introducing President Obama in his speech, and he was talking about health care, and he said, This is from a report on MSNBC. Schweitzer raised a few eyebrows when he introduced Obama by declaring his unabashed love for Canada's government-run healthcare program. And he said, look, they're just a couple miles across the border right there in Canada, and they're doing a good job. They've had single payer since for 62 years. And they've got a good healthcare system, and it ranks better than the U.S. healthcare system. So, well, that was interesting. Now, if you're a Democrat or you're progressive, that makes sense, right? Not President Obama, does it? When President Obama came up to speak, he wanted to make it very clear that he was not on Schweitzer's side. He didn't want anybody to mistake him for a progressive. He said, quote, I'm not in favor of a Canadian system. I'm not in favor of a British system. I'm not in favor of a French system. What we've said is, let's find a uniquely American system. Yeah, nice little line there. In other words, hell no, no interest in single payer. Not clear enough? Well, it was clarifying to Schweitzer, who's the governor of Montana, right afterwards, because this is what MSNBC reports next. After the speeches were over, Obama sat Schweitzer down for a private talk. According to Schweitzer, the president said his voice wasn't helping the healthcare debate and asked him to step away. How do you like that? Your voice is not helping us. In other words, your progressive voice, not useful here. We're not interested. We're not going to go for a single payer. We don't want single payer. And then, look, think about it. Even if he didn't want single payer, if you were progressive and you wanted a better, a juster, cheaper system that was more efficient, if you had actually split the difference, you might have come up with an interesting plan. But instead, President Obama had no interest in that, right? So if you're not convinced yet, let's go to Kathleen Sebelius. Now, MSNBC reports, remember, she's head of HHS, Department of Health and Human Services. Asked if the administration's program will be drafted specifically to prevent it from evolving into a single-payer plan, Sebelius says, this is back in 2009, I think that's very much the case. And again, if you want anybody to convince people of that, talk to the single-payer proponents who are furious that the single-payer idea is not part of the discussion. So there it is, from the horse's mouth. So Sebelius, Obama, the administration never, ever, 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 ever wanted to do single payer, fought against it tooth and nail behind the scenes because, there's only two possible options there, I think. Three if you're generous. One is, they didn't want single payer and they didn't want the public option because they're conservative. They agree with the Heritage Foundation, and that's why they did ultimately what was the Heritage Foundation's plan. That's the simplest answer. I know it blows people's minds, but don't judge a man by his words, as the Bible says, judge him by his deeds, right? That's exactly what he did. Second option is President Obama is so sad and weak that he's like, I don't know. I mean, look, sad and weak is one option. Like, that you were so scared that they would call you a leftist that you left out a perfectly good option that would have helped you in negotiations, right? But what? But then the third option is you're stupid, because anybody could tell you that would help you in negotiations. But I think if I give my final proposal in the beginning, the Republicans will like me so much that they'll just give it to me. If that's not stupid, what do you call it, right? But I don't think it's because he's weak or he's stupid or he's just the worst negotiator in American history. I think that's the system he likes, he agrees with. He agrees with Mitt Romney, he agrees with the Heritage Foundation. That's why he adopted their plan, and that's why he fought against every progressive proposal behind the scenes. So, newsflash for you, the president's not a progressive.
So, and of course many of us have known that. And in fact, if anything, it's the progressive who've separated themselves from the corporate, liberal and corporate conservative groups to look for the truth, wherever it may be. I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today, where we're talking about the issues that make a difference in our lives. Let's go over now and say hello to our guest, who is standing by to talk about an issue that rarely gets covered. But first, let's just take one little break for a few seconds, get our guest on the line. Back in a moment.
Ooh, goodbye, man.
Nice to have you with us, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. From Berkeley, California, Dr. Marcy Shapiro, medical doctor, board certified in family practice, specializing in integrative medicine. In addition to her conventional medical education, she's also trained in mind-body techniques, Western and Chinese herbal medicine, acupuncture, nutritional therapies, and a variety of hands-on modalities. And she's also been an instructor in herbal and natural health for over 25 years and practices individualized medicine that balances the physical and spiritual dimensions of the patient. Her website is Marcey Shapiro, MD.com, and she's the author of Freedom from Anxiety. Nice to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's really nice to be on your show.
After the 2000-2008 economic collapse, we have been witnessing a dramatic and steady increase in various anxiety disorders, such as generalized anxiety disorder, that's often associated with fears and worries over work and family and personal finances and health and just getting by from one day to the next. I'm sure this is true for many other listeners right now. And this, in turn, can develop into more serious anxiety disorders, such as panic disorders and phobias and obsessive-compulsive disorders. One study shows 1,200% increase in anxiety disorders during the last 30 years, which is now 1 in 76 people. And Harvard's Dr. Marcia Engel has noted a startling 3,500% rise in children with anxiety disorders in the last 20 years. And a Gallup poll last year found that 70% of Americans hate their jobs, almost 50% of students are burdened with student loan debts, and there's not a great deal of hope for the majority of students to have a suitable job to repay their loans after graduation. And finally, the medical science shows repeatedly anxiety and stress is deeply associated with the onset of a large variety of stress-related illnesses and immune-compromised conditions. So I'd like you to begin by defining anxiety for us and its onset and how it can progress to more serious mental disorders if left unchecked. And then how does anxiety adversely impact the body's immune system and can lead to other health complications?
So a good definition of anxiety is that it is an abnormal and overwhelming sense of apprehension or fear of misfortune that can be accompanied by physiologic signs like increased sweating, heart pounding, and muscle tension. But I prefer the Buddhist teacher Thich Nhat Hanh's explanation of anxiety, which is anxiety, the illness of our time, comes primarily from our inability to dwell in the present moment. And I prefer that because that kind of shows us a way out of the door of anxiety. It does have profound effects on the immune system. So the immune system is actually linked to positive mood, and proper functioning of the immune system is really linked to feelings of well-being. So the endorphin system, our natural opiates, really boost the function of the immune system. And stress and anxiety really suppress the function of the immune system and can lead to a host of diseases, particularly the inflammatory diseases that are so prevalent and kind of at the basis of many different health problems today. So the thing to note is that with immune function, with any of this, if there was no way to change anxiety, if people were just stuck being anxious or not anxious, then this would be kind of a disempowering conversation. However, if there are ways to change your set point, if there are ways to relieve anxiety and find more serenity and more ease, then you can profoundly affect not only your health, but also the well-being of those around you. And so that was one of my main reasons for writing this book.
Okay, I'd like to hear your comments on the notion that our society breeds anxiety. For example, does our society encourage enthusiasm and nurture respectful relationships, or rather does it encourage passivity and manipulative relationships?
I would say, unfortunately, it is the latter. It's a lot of what you were quoting before, where fear is really the new norm in our society. And I think anxiety is essentially a disempowering state, which keeps people passive. And so in our society, I mean, so much of what you just said a little while ago is so true, that people are frightened and they're just trying to get their little bit, and they are not connecting with one another. And I think that that's one of the main things that we look for in relief of anxiety, is, you know, satisfying that hunger for connection that we all have with one another, with community, with society, and with other individuals. So, yes, I think that it's not at all surprising to me that anxiety has really skyrocketed since the economic problems of the late, you know, the late part of the last decade, and will continue to skyrocket as people have more isolation. They feel more and more disconnected from one another. They're in unhappy work situations. They're in unhappy personal situations. They're not spending time in nature and doing the things that really nurture them. And, you know, I think that there's a method, unfortunately, to the madness, which is that anxiety is paralyzing and it prevents people from taking action. It also blocks insight for positive action that can be taken. And as Margaret Mead pointed out, the individual is the only thing that has ever changed society. So if people are paralyzed with their anxiety and not taking action, then the status quo can just continue.
You've identified a wide range of therapeutic modalities that can relieve anxiety, which can allow a person to also reduce their own. There's a large body of evidence on the benefits of meditation to reduce anxiety. And since you've practiced meditation almost daily since you were 16, which forms of meditation have you found most beneficial for people suffering from anxiety disorders?
Well, I think it's very individual. I usually advise people to start with learning breathing exercises, because one of the nice things about breathing exercises is that it doesn't have to be done for a long time to start to shift the emotional state. It brings people into the present moment, and they can do it for as short as a minute or two and start to notice positive benefits from that. So I teach a breathing exercise, which I called heart-centered breathing exercise, where people just essentially breathe in and out through the center of the chest. And it doesn't have to be any kind of deep breath or anything like that. It can just be normal breaths, but focusing the awareness on the center of the chest, which in Chinese medicine is CV17, and it has a lot to do with our feelings of peace. And so doing that, and it can be done with the eyes open or the eyes closed, so if someone's in a business meeting or in a stressful conversation, they can focus their awareness there. Of course, longer meditations are wonderful. A lot of times when people have a great deal of anxiety, walking meditations are actually more easy for them to perform than seated meditations, and I've seen that with a lot of my patients. So walking a labyrinth, or even walking meditatively in nature. Nature is a great soother and great healer for the spirit, and really helps people connect in with their inner sense of wisdom and knowing.
Last question for you. There are certain nutrient supplements and amino acids and herbs that have been found to be especially effective in helping people deal with this. Have you found that to be the case?
I have totally found that to be the case, and there are many, many examples of that in my book. So I can just mention a few of them that are some of the most useful and some of the most popular. One would be magnesium. Magnesium, of course, is the fourth most prevalent mineral in our bodies, and one that is really associated with the calming portion of the nervous system, the parasympathetic. And so magnesium helps muscles to relax. It helps us to access better sleep. It stops muscle twitching. And it just helps with generalized calming. And it's very important in many different enzymatic reactions of the body. Now, magnesium is laxative, so I always want to let people know that ahead of time if they're thinking of supplementing with it. But many of our diets are deficient in magnesium because of conventional agricultural practices really deplete the soils of this important nutrient. So magnesium supplementation can be really helpful. And generally, I recommend supplementation with magnesium glycinate or magnesium citrate. And I'll talk a little bit about glycine. So magnesium is always bound to something. Glycine is an amino acid, and amino acids can also be very helpful in supporting positive mood. Glycine helps the body to build more GABA, which is the neurotransmitter of calm. It's been shown to be effective in obsessive compulsive disorder. And magnesium bound to glycine kind of gives a extra benefit to the magnesium. And it also gives the glycine. So glycine itself can be taken as a supplement. Normal dose would be about 500 milligrams twice a day. And then one other supplement I would mention is inositol, which is in the B complex family of vitamins. And it also is very helpful for helping people to calm down, to decrease repetitive thoughts, intrusive feeling thoughts, and it's very safe. And so I will often recommend those. In terms of the world of herbs, there's really lots of them. There's commonplace herbs that people don't think of enough, like chamomile is very relaxing and calming to the nervous system. It's also an excellent antiviral. So when people are under stress, they're more vulnerable to infections and viral infections. So they get the calming benefits of chamomile, which is an herb which has been used in terms of our documented knowledge of it for well over 2,000 years. And they get the antiviral benefits of that.
That's all good. We're out of time. I thank you very much, Marcy Shapiro, for coming on and sharing some insights about dealing with anxiety in an anxious age. The website is marcyshapiromd.com. The book is Freedom from Anxiety. Thank you for being with us. I'm Gary Knoll. Now let's say hello to Luann Panessis, who's in studio in New York City. Hi, Luann.
Hello, Gary. I have a very interesting email here from one of your favorite groups, a medical doctor. He says, for the first 25 years of my life, I would have called myself a conservative with great family values. At the urging of my daughter, I attended a lecture of yours 15 years ago. In it, you touched upon why doctors are afraid to look at the truth of their own profession's limitations. However, your lecture wasn't an attack on medicine, but rather a challenge of the power of our beliefs, including that of the medical doctors. I remember you saying, and I've said this many times since, that it's not cancer or heart disease or stroke that kills people, it's their belief system. The rest of the lecture, you deconstructed how we become commodified objects, and we have virtually no self-awareness in the choices that we make. And of course, the brighter and more successful one becomes, the more limited their view of what the truth is. I walked out of the lecture angry, I remember, but I was also inspired. I tried for the next year to disprove everything you had said, but really what I found was that I only reaffirmed it. So for about 10 years, I became a liberal, he says. Now I feel I'm a progressive. My question is this: with so much evidence of our failures and all of our beliefs and institutions, why has there been no fundamental change? No students revolting against a system that indentures them? Look at the unions, they've become impotent, and the working class essentially invisible. Which is why every night, by the way, I've been downloading your programs from the archives. After my day, it's like breathing in a breath of fresh air.
There's a very famous philosopher. He said, "We are never deceived. We deceive ourselves." His name begins with a G. Do you know who he is?
Oh, dear. I don't do philosophers on Tuesday. Go ahead.
All right. If anyone knows who said that, "We are never deceived. We deceive ourselves," call us at 888-874-4888. I'd like to see if we have people up on their philosopher.
I can guess, but I'll let someone call in.
All right, there are several reasons why we do not see transformations. First, the working class in the United States is coming from fear, and rightly so. Because it's not like you and I were going to school, and if we didn't like a particular job, we could go out and find many other different jobs available to us. If they lose their job, they're likely only having 1 week worth of funds That's it. They have one single week of money. Then what's going to be there to pay for their food, their mortgage, their rent, their car, their insurance, their phone? So that's a limitation. You also had to realize that historically, back in the 1800s, the early 1900s, and clearly by the 1920s, the working class were the major fomenters of reform. They were the ones doing the major strikes. They're the ones who caused us to get the 40-hour work week and unemployment insurance and Social Security and minimum wage. They started that. But they were given the background of strong people like John L. Lewis. And the unions have been eviscerated. They've been attacked. They've been defunded of their legitimacy by those who have the power to try to say that we need a free market. So the unions used to be the major organizers. They protected the working class, not today. Also, who do you know who really has job security? The moment you start speaking out and you show yourself as a potential thorn in someone's side in the workplace, you're high probability you're going to be fired. It was the young people in the 1960s and 70s that were the primary force for social change. We took to the campuses. I remember being up at Columbia campus and protesting. We were the ones against the Vietnam War. We were the ones fighting on behalf of the civil rights movement and the free speech movement and the feminist movement and the right of animals movement. Today, we don't have any such movement from the students for a lot of reasons, not the least of which I just did in a commentary, but also the fact that they're loaded with $1 trillion in debt. The vast majority of students will not have a paying job or a good paying job when they get out of college. They're going to have to go home and live with parents or relatives. And this does not allow for them to feel empowered. So when you have students who are not politically and socially engaged, and you have them loaded with debt and under severe anxiety, and you have a police state willing to repress people, and you have infiltration of every single movement in the United States around the world, where everyone is listened to, every thought is measured, then where do you have the very means of causing social change? You don't. As a result, 98% of all doctors are still orthodox in everything they do because it's safe. And this true is nurses, dietitians, academics. If you want a challenge, watch how quickly you become, you know, and they can't take you from a tenure, but they certainly will make you an adjunct professor, which means you make about $22,000 a year. So that is crucial. That's why we don't have a movement today. Hope that answers your question. Let's say hello now to Utrice Lead. Hi, Utrice.
Hello, Gary. It's Tuesday, therefore it's open forum. The airtime is for listeners to have their say.
Great. Utrice Lead, coming at you right now. And I think, Utrice, one of the things that we are seeing, and maybe you'll get some calls on this today, what happens to a society that grew up in the 1950s and 60s and 70s, where people took great pride in the being responsible for themselves, their families, their communities? And now, as that senior citizen society, the aging baby boomer society, realizes society has changed, what approaches can they take today to still be viable and vital and still be a part of the changes that are coming? That's just something hopefully people will call in and ask you about. Utrice Lead, right now.